God. I'm Lacey. I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Oh, Lacey.
And just bear with me. It takes me a couple minutes to get warmed up here. But, you know, I have, basically, when I share my story, I like to just be as honest as possible. And, you know, basically just tell you guys what it was like for me, you know, before I started drinking, during my drinking and using, what happened to me, and then what it's like for me today. So I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, and I started, you know, drinking at a relatively young age. And the first time I took a drink of alcohol, I definitely remember that feeling. I remember that feeling like they describe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the sense of ease and comfort that came at once when I took my first drink. What I've come to realize now, having gone through the steps and having been in recovery, is that my problems with drugs and alcohol came long before I ever picked up a drink or a drug. I spoke a couple weeks ago at a Sunday night meeting, and like the way I described like the person that I was as a child or as a young adult was full of fear, scared of everything. I was way too overwhelmed by like the world, basically. I can remember being a younger kid and being like, there is no way I'm going to ever be able to navigate this world. It's too complicated. There's too much going on. I'm really, really nervous. I'm really nervous to live. And, you know, prior to ever picking up a drink or a drug, I had that fear that crippled me in so many ways. And, you know, I attempted suicide as a young child. You know, I was seeing therapists when I was 5 years old. Like, there was something wrong with me. But when I drank for that first time, I was, for the first time in my life, comfortable in my own skin. I was okay for, like, the first time ever. So what happened to me was, you know, I drank casually. I drank on the weekends. I couldn't wait to drink. I put myself in, you know, situations as a young kid, you know, collecting money and standing outside of the mall waiting for guys that I thought were old enough to buy for me. Like, I already made silly decisions based on my love of booze, you know. So even though I hadn't crossed that invisible line yet into what I would call today, you know, an alcoholic, I definitely was already making sacrifices and compromising to drink. So basically, I continued on like that for a really long time. Just, you know, like many of us probably in here, I went to parties, I hung out, you know, I probably made some really poor decisions as far as like men go and, you know, sex and all that good stuff that we get ourselves involved in when we're under the influence, and we probably shouldn't. But, you know, I went through all of that. And I grew up pretty much, you know, other than, you know, I would have to say I didn't have, you know, I didn't have a terrible life. But for me, I guess the only way I can describe it is I was, everywhere I went, I was, if that makes any sense to you guys. I went with me everywhere I went, and I couldn't stand me. So the problem, or you know, my solution to that was to drink and do drugs. And it worked for me for a really long time. I honestly believe, like, if I hadn't found booze and drugs, like, I probably would have killed myself a long time ago. I truly believe that. But for me, I covered up a lot of my abuse of alcohol and drugs with, you know, doing right in society's eyes. I got straight A's. I played sports. I traveled. I was president of every club you can imagine. Like, I definitely overcompensated so that I could hide my drinking and drugging from, you know, from the people around me. I graduated from high school and I went on to college. And I went to a really good college. You know, I basically at that point, I can honestly remember having, you know, on my way to college, and, you know, I hadn't developed a drug habit at that point, but I was definitely, you know, drinking more heavily at that point in time. But when I went away to college, I really realized for the first time that, you know, I was getting older and that I had to start, like, making decisions, and I had to start living living life, and that scared me to death. And so for me, I blotted all that out with drugs and alcohol. I was really too afraid to do anything. So in college, I became addicted to Oxycontin, which later led to, you know, using a intravenous needle. I was a cocaine addict, and, you know, I used heroin to come down from the cocaine. But I went from, you know, I guess my family would say, like, a girl with a promising future to, you know, a pretty big junkie in, you know, 40 years, or I should say less than that. But, you know, that's pretty much, like, you know, that's pretty much what happened to me as far as, like, my drinking and drugging goes, which is really not even the important part of the story. That's really just what we all go through. But let me just back up a little bit to let you know, well, not back up, but once I graduated college, my senior year in college, I graduated and I had a job in New York City. I was going to be a teacher in an inner city school. And the day before I was supposed to leave for New York, I called them and said I wasn't coming. I decided that it would be a better idea to stay and waitress in Boston, mostly because I was afraid that, which sounds really silly to me today, that I wouldn't be able to find my drugs in New York. I know. But at the time, I knew where they were, and I knew how to get them, and I was too afraid. So I made a decision to not go take a job based on the fact that I needed my drugs. I had since then, you know, probably a couple years prior to that, crossed what, you know, I'll describe later as that invisible line that sent me, you know, past the point of no return. And, you know, when I graduated, I didn't go. I stayed back. I stayed in Boston. I waitressed. I picked up another waitressing job. Oh, yes, I'm very successful. I'm wonderful. You know, I am at this point, I'm a complete disaster. You know, I'm about 90 pounds soaking wet. I was really, really sick. And what happened to me was I drove to the Tobin Bridge, and I climbed on top of, like, the second story, and I, you know, called my mother, and I said, you know, this is it, I'm done, you know, I can't live like this anymore, and, you know, put the phone down, and I stared over the edge, and it was, like, the blackest, most darkest thing, like, I've ever seen in my life, and, you know, I don't know if I was, like, chicken or what was happening, but obviously I didn't jump, I'm here, but I was pondering it, and crying, and, you know, what am I going to do? You know, I can't go on like this, but I can't get better. So I ended up getting pulled down from the bridge from a man in a red pickup truck. To this day, I don't know who it was, but he pulled me down. I then got into my car, sped away, and the police were chasing me. My mother had called in a suicide attempt. It was pretty ugly. Landed myself in Boston Medical Center in a locked ward in a padded room. You know, pretty much, I was a psychopath at that point. So, you know, I remember at that point, you know, the gig was up, right? Okay, like, my family knows. I just tried to commit suicide. You know, I'm definitely, you know, I probably don't have things under control. for me, I ended up coaxing my way, like we do so well, out of Boston Medical Center and telling my parents I knew what I could do to be different. I knew what the problem was, and I just needed to stop using. So that was my beginning of, you know, my introduction into recovery. When I first got into recovery, I went into a detox. I was, for the first time in my entire, like, 10 years of using, I was actually detoxed from all, like, drugs. I had not been off of drugs for about 8 or 9 years at that point. I consistently used. And I went into a treatment facility and I said, you know what, I'll give this a try. And you know, for me, I got out and I did what they told me to do, 90 and 90, got a sponsor, you know, I did all this stuff. And it was about 6 months. I had been in the treatment locked up, you know, pretty much for 3 months. So now I'm on my own for another 3 months and I'm on my way to a meeting one day and my car just swerves right down the driveway of the dealer's house. And you know, it was, that was it for me. I was using again. So up to this point, like for me, I had no idea what was really going on. I had no idea what it meant to be an alcoholic or a drug addict. I had no idea that alcohol and drugs were the answer to my problems and that my problems were me, that I was full of fear, that I was, you know, I was in constant collision with the world. I was basically trying to manage my life based on, like, ego and self-righteousness, and I believed in my heart of hearts that the world owed me, that I was a, you know, basically I felt like I was an alien from another planet and that I didn't belong here, but if I was going to have to be here, then you people better be nice, you know, I mean, that was pretty much what it was like for me. Every single thing I did, when I look back today, I mean, I didn't realize, and I didn't even mean to be such an ugly person, but I really, really was. You know, this is a little tangent, but I was talking to my mom today on the phone, and I don't know if you guys, when you guys are doing stuff, sometimes those evil things that you've done, they come back, and your stomach, like, jumps, and you're like, oh, I remember when I did that awful thing. But I was talking to my mom today, and I was thinking how just 2 years ago, I was calling her a, I don't want to swear because it's not right, but a bitch. And I was, like, swearing at her, telling her how much I hated her and what a C-U-N-T she was and all this stuff. I mean, this is how I treated my mother, who, like, would have died for me, you know? And it is sick. It is sick what I did to my family, what I did to my friends, what I did to the people that loved me. But I only have come to that place by having taken steps and having learned what it meant to be a real addict and a real alcoholic. So in that time when I had been sober for that 6 months, what that looked like for me was hell. It was like hell. I was, you know, I was trapped in my own body. I remember just driving down the street going, please God, keep me away from drink drug. Please keep me away from drink drug. Please keep me. That's like all I could say over and over in my head. I was in prison, right? I mean, so I was better off high because at least I could do things. So, you know, I used at that point and I continued on for another 3 years in and out of AA, in and out of recovery. You know, I began a needle habit. I began to... you know, use intravenous drugs. I went through all my money. I started stealing. I started cheating, lying, using on the job, not, you know, all these different things, breaking the law constantly. Obviously, I mean, when I was getting high, I was, but, you know, getting arrested, losing jobs. You know, this is, that was what it looked like for me, you know, in those 2.5 years after I was introduced to recovery or sobriety, you know, really, I was just a deer, you know, in the headlights, is that what they say? That's what I was. You know, I was absolutely out of my mind, and I had no idea what was going on. So what happened to me was I ended up using drugs one night, and I ended up, I had started using drugs intravenously, like I said, and I was shooting them up in my neck, and I got... cut off my airway and was in the ICU for 3 days. Like, they didn't have to intubate me, but that's why I was in the ICU, because I had basically closed off my breathing airway. So when I came to in the ICU, I was, you know, I remember laying there, and my mom and aunt and my sponsor were there, and they said, you know, what's going to be different? And I was like, oh, don't worry about it. I know what I'm going to do. I just got to stop shooting coke. You know, that's it. That's the only thing I have to do. So I had all the answers, but I had just lost my job. Obviously I was shooting up in the bathroom and they found all the needles and the blood all over the ceiling, and I was really bad at that. And so they, you know, I in like on my deathbed, the guy's like, yeah, you're not coming back to work. I'm like, but why? Like, I'm such a good employee. Like, only once. So what happened at that point was I believe for the first time, like, I honestly had some sort of spiritual experience at that moment. I was willing, for the first time, willing to maybe understand that my way wasn't working and that I really had to take some suggestions. So I go to, you know, the detox I went to like 100,000 times before, and I went back again, and, you know, I'm sitting there, and they're like, well, what's going to be different? And I honestly, I didn't know, but my sponsor had said to me at the time, you need long-term treatment. Now, I wasn't willing to give up anything. I wasn't willing to ever take any suggestions that inconvenienced me. You see, I had to get home to my job and to my friends and to everything that was important because I was so successful and so wonderful. And everybody loved me. Really, everybody didn't want me around. Nobody could stand me. I was a complete nightmare. And I was a train wreck. And my friends didn't even want me around, let alone my family. And, but, like, I really thought that that was where I needed to be for so, you know, for all those times coming in and out of detox. But this time, I listened to somebody. It had to have been God because there's no way on my own I would have done that. And I did. I went to into a long-term treatment facility. It's funny because I ended up staying there for 3.5 months, but it was really like one of these 2 to 3 week deals. And when I told my sponsor, you know, I'm going, it's only 3 weeks, she's like, that's not long term. But like, it was a step for me. It was a little, to me, that was a long time, 3 weeks, you know? So what happened to me, you know, at this treatment facility that I went to, they gave me this book and they gave me a notebook and they said, that's all you're going to need, and a pen. And I was like, you know, what are these people talking about? Like, no, that's not all I need. I need my perfume. They wouldn't let me have my perfume. They wouldn't let me, and this is how I was. I was like, no, I need this, and I need this, and I need all these things to be okay. And they were like, no, really, all you need is this. And I was like, what are these people talking about? These people are crazy. Don't they know who I am? But I went, I got there, and I was introduced to the 12 steps. And I get really pumped about this. So don't mind me if I become animated, but I was introduced to the 12 steps, and right at the beginning, it talks about how people can recover from alcoholism. Now, I sat in AA for a long time, and I was sober for 10 months strictly on fear and, like, you know, holding on to the edge of my seat, you know, for fear, really, because I was afraid to pee dirty and go to jail. It was, honestly, it kept me clean for that long. But the second I got off probation, I was in a junked car because I worked at a tow company. It was going to be a junked car, and I opened the glove compartment, and there were needles in there. God knows whose, and next thing I know, I was shooting coke in the bathroom at work. So clearly, being afraid didn't keep me sober. You know, it kept me clean for as long as it could. But I was using as soon as I got off probation. But when I got to this place and I opened and I opened up the book and they talked about being recovered from alcoholism and drug addiction, I was like, bullshit, you know, excuse my language, but there's no way, you don't ever recover. That's what they say, you know, you're a recovering alcoholic or addict. And, you know, that was pretty much like my first indication of, in my experience, that, okay, these people are different. There's something different going on here. They're talking about recovering and being recovered from alcoholism. They are the people that were there at this place. They're addicts and alcoholics just like me. They actually have a life. They get up in the morning. They brush their teeth. They take showers. They have nice clothes. Like, they actually live a normal, what looks to me, appears to be a normal life. Whatever that looks like. So I kind of tuned into what they said, and I sat through my first big book session, and they went through what's called the doctor's opinion. It's the first chapter in the book, or it's actually not a chapter, it's the beginning preface or whatever to the book. But and they talked to me about what it means to be an alcoholic and an addict. And what they described to me was that there are two things that make us an alcoholic and an addict. One is our mind and the mental obsession we have around drugs and alcohol. And two is our body, that we're physically different. That, you know, my best friend Carly, who drinks and drugs just like I do, but stops at a certain point. She doesn't suffer from what I have in my body, and that's an allergy. That's basically it's like an allergy to anything. Once I start drinking or drugging, I can't stop. I don't know when I'm going to stop. I don't know where I'm going to end up. I only know that I need to be stopped by force or by running out of money or by passing out. I don't really ever know when I'm going to stop. See, Carly could drink and drug just with the best of us, but she didn't have that allergy, so she's not an alcoholic or an addict. She could stop whenever she said so. She could stop. So I learned, I mean, I'm listening to this, and I'm like, oh my God, yeah, like, this makes sense. Like, I never know when I can stop, and I just keep going and going and going. Like I say, Mom, I swear I'm just going to have one, but I don't ever come home. And I say to myself, you know, I'm just going to, you know, it's my cut. The next day, it says Friday night, and the next day is my cousin's wedding, and I'm in the wedding, and I'm just going to have a few drinks, maybe even shoot up a little bit. But, you know, I mean, I really did that. That's what I told myself. But I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be fine for the wedding. Now it goes Friday night, happens, and all day Saturday, and I'm drinking and doing drugs, and all of a sudden it's Saturday at 5, and I'm supposed to be at my hair appointment and have the dress on. And, yeah, right, like, I'm not stopping. There's no way. You know, I mean, my mother would plead with me. My father would plead with me. Please, tonight, just come home. We need you to come home. Okay, I'll just have one. And I would start, and I had no idea when I was going to stop. So I identified with that. I related with that. I said, oh, my God, I do. I have what you're talking about, that allergy. And then they talked about the mental obsession that we suffer. And they're talking to me, and they're saying, you know, or excuse me, they're reading out of this book that's, you know, written however many years ago, and it's saying exactly what, you know, what it's like to be in my shoes, in my head, in my, you know, in my life. And they're talking about the mental obsession that even though when I do stop, that I can't stay stopped, that I'm constantly thinking about it, right? Like, it's running my life. So I'm at work for a day, right? And I wake up and I don't get high that morning and I don't drink and I get to work and it's like 5 minutes and I'm like, oh my God, when can I do it again? When can I do it again? When can I do it again? That's all I'm saying all day long. And, you know, of course, it used to be at 9:30 when the shift was over, the waitress and shift. Then it was 8:30. Then it was calling people while I'm waiting on tables and being like, okay, bring me this and I'll meet you here. And then I'm just drinking at 10 in the morning. I mean, because the obsession's so great that I can't even overcome it. And not only that, but the obsession to me looks like also I can be not even thinking about alcohol or drugs. I can have been, you know, without it for some time, and then the second I think about it, I'm off. That's it. I'm done. Like, there is no if and there's no defense against it. You know, there's no, I don't think about the consequences. I don't rationalize it. That's actually what the mental obsession is. It's an unrational response or something like this that's like persistent. And I don't know, you can look up the definition, but it's just whatever it is, it sucks. It really does. It's a terrible thing, and it boggled my mind, right? It absolutely put me out. The mental obsession was more frustrating to me than I think the allergy, because I was like, honest to God, I don't want to use. I would go to work in the morning and say, God, please, like, I don't even want to use. And the second I would think about it, I would be using. It was just the most amazing thing, you know, most unbelievable thing I've ever experienced. Because I just couldn't believe that I had no mental control over this problem. So basically, you know, I start getting into the book, and they describe to me what it's like to be an addict, an alcoholic, like I just described to you. So if you can relate to any of that, like, that's what it's like when you're an addict or an alcoholic. You have this mental obsession that you can't overcome. You can't rationalize through it. You can't imagine that you have to be at a wedding, you know, the next day or anything like that. You know, you get the idea to use and you use. You know, One of the more important things I learned too was that when I had first been in AA, you know, all this talk about triggers, right? So I didn't even understand because everything was a trigger to me. Life was a trigger. I was really miserable, and I would, you know, if I had to stay sober and avoid all triggers, like I would need a diaper because I couldn't go to the bathroom because I used in every bathroom. I wouldn't be able to leave, like, I wouldn't be able to be anywhere because I used in my house, and every person I saw reminded me of drugs. Everywhere I went reminded me of using. So basically, like, if triggers are just staying out of seedy bars and bad places and changing my phone number, you know, those are all good things, but if that was my answer to how I was going to get better, I was screwed. I was absolutely screwed because there was no way I could avoid all the triggers. I mean, life was my trigger, right? I drank and drugged when it was sunny, when the Red Sox won, when the Red Sox lost, when the Patriots won, when the Patriots lost. You know, I drank when my mother yelled at me. I drank when my mother was proud of me. I drugged when my father was drinking and being a lunatic, and I drugged when he wasn't. So really, what came to me was nothing. I can't avoid triggers. And also, what came to my like attention at this point was that I didn't drink for any other reason besides the fact that I liked the effects produced by alcohol and drugs. And that was also something that came out of the doctor's opinion. The doctor's opinion is like a fabulous part of the book. If anybody has yet to go through it, it's pretty eye-opening. But, you know, it says right in there that I drink because I like the effects produced by alcohol. And I can remember thinking for so many years what the reason for my drinking was. You know, my dad was an alcoholic. And so I kind of grew up, you know, fine, but, like, it was definitely hectic. You know, it was a lot of yelling and screaming and pillows over my ears. So that must be why I drink. You know, I really, really, you know, always tried to put my finger on what the reason for my drinking and drugging was. You know, it come to find out I like it. I like the way it makes me feel. It takes me out of myself. It gets me, makes me feel comfortable. I can talk to you. I can function. You know, that's why I do it. But because I'm mentally and bodily different than your average drinker or heavy drinker or moderate drinker, I don't have the luxury of drinking and drugging anymore. So I like I said, I continued to sit through these big books, and more was revealed to me. I realized that, it was pointed out to me that I was selfish, that I was egotistical, that I was trying to arrange the world to suit me, that I was only happy if you were doing what I wanted and I was, you know, and I was getting what I wanted. I really, really believed that everybody was out to get me. I believed that there was a black cloud over me, that I had, like, really bad, must be really bad luck, had nothing to do with me, but I really did. I believed that I had really bad luck for a long time. I pointed the finger. I blamed everybody else for my problems. I never took responsibility for anything I did. I was really sick. I was a really, really sick person. And what I learned was that alcohol and drugs were my solution and that I was my problem. So if I was ever going to get better, I needed to find a new solution. And, you know, going through this book, they pointed out to me that there is a solution. You know, it's a chapter in the book. It describes this relationship to the world, this relationship to a higher power, that if you can actually be willing to believe that there's something greater than you, that you know, that there's something out there that makes the world go round, or however you want to say it, and that it has the power to heal you, that it has the power to change you. You know, if you can believe in that, and you can seek it out, that it has a power to, you know, you seek it out and it meets you halfway is basically the gist of what I got. So, you know, I'm at this point where I've tried everything else, right? I mean, I've tried to just drink. I tried to just snort drugs. I tried to just not shoot them. I tried to go to... I lived in Australia one time. Oh, that was really fun. I lived there for 6 months, and I convinced myself I wasn't a drug addict because I couldn't find any drugs, so I just drank 24 hours straight. But, like, that was my justification. I'm not a drug addict because I lasted 7 months without drugs. But I was in oblivion the whole time. You know, I can't... I basically just lost my train of thought what was the thing. But do you remember what I was saying?
Australia.
But before Australia. What was my point? I tried everything under the sun to fix my... But this is fun. We're amongst friends, right? I could be myself. So, I'm silly. So, I tried everything under the sun to get better. I mean, like I said, I went to Australia. I did all these crazy, outrageous things, you know, to try to make myself better. And at this point, I had exhausted all my options. I know you guys must relate to that on some level. I really had. I had exhausted all my options. So this idea of, like, that there's something out there governing this world that's greater than me, and that if I seek it out, it will help me to get better. Well, that was my best option because I didn't have any other options. And, like, I really honestly, like, I was going to die. I was going to die if not by, like, the drugs and alcohol I was putting into my body. I was going to blow my brains out. And I there was just no way I could go on. I either had to get it, or I had to, like that saying from Shawshank Redemption, get busy living or get busy dying, because, like, I was screwed. So, you know, I accepted the ideas outlined in the book. I accepted this idea of a higher power. That's it. I just started simple. I just started praying for little things, like to be kind, to be generous, to be compassionate, to be nice to my mother when I called her, to be happy for my father when he talked to me. You know, instead of always taking, I asked God to help me to give a little. To ask people how their day was going, not to sit there and rant and rave for an hour about how bad my day was going. You know, I mean, that's what I did. And I wondered why I got in fights with people all the time. You know, I wonder why I was in constant collision with the world. Well, I was such a taker and never a giver. And you know, I didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't know this about myself. I really didn't. I honestly, you know, I didn't. And when it was finally, like, spoon-fed to me that, like, you're a selfish person and you really, really try to control everything and use everything to your advantage, you know, I really started to open my eyes because I couldn't argue with that. I had the experiences to back it up. I believed what these people were saying. So what I did is I took a third step. I made a commitment to God to continue on with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I took a third step, you know, it wasn't this, like, white light didn't come down and, like, strike me new and all that stuff. But it definitely, I felt something. I felt something for the first time, some sort of connection. Now, for me, I didn't have an issue believing in God because I've seen some really beautiful things in the world, like sunsets and lakes and oceans. And I've been to Australia. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And I've seen some pretty amazing things that, to me, makes me think that there's something else out there, you know, that there's something bigger than us out there to create this beauty that I see in the world. So I didn't have a hard time hooking onto that idea that there was a God and that I could seek him and he could be found. So I took a third step. I went on to write an honest and thorough inventory. And what an inventory is, it's a sex inventory, and a resentment, a fear, and a sex inventory. So, you know, when I was first introduced to the steps a while ago, there was, the steps were on the wall, and I remember saying, and this was like a really, you know, this was like 2 years before I got sober this last time. So it was like in 2005 or something like that, and I remember looking on the wall and I was like, I don't have resentment. Like, I don't even have any resentments against anybody. Everything's fine. And, you know, I write a resentment inventory and it was 150 people long, so I was really, really mistaken. But that's not the first time that I've been wrong about things. So I wrote a resentment inventory and a fear inventory and a sex inventory. Basically, what that experience was like for me was absolutely amazing. I put down on paper all these things that I had against people and the world. And the purpose of the inventory, right, was to, you know, they call it in the book like house cleaning or something like that. But for me, too, it was also, and they also refer to it in the book as, you know, in that there is a solution part. They talk about, like, you really need to, like, rearrange all your ideas. And I don't know, I can't quote the book, but it's something about, like, realigning yourself with, like, what's actually, you know, going on in the world. Because, like, see, I'm over here and everybody else is doing what's, like looks like life, and I'm, like, out here somewhere being, like, a lunatic. So, like, I need to, like, get rid of all these ideas, and I need to, like, get rid of all this crap that's burying me and separating me from God and from other people and preventing me from living any sort of normal life. I need to get rid of that all. And the exercise they tell me to do in here is to write it down on paper and to go through it and to take every resentment and to basically look at it and put what the other person did aside and see where I was at fault, see where I was fearful, dishonest, self-seeking, or selfish. And that's a pretty amazing exercise. When I first started to write it, my mom was the first one, and I remember just breaking down in tears because I hated her for so many things, and I couldn't believe that they were all of my own making. I definitely could easily see in my resentment inventory that my life was unmanageable with drugs and alcohol because there were some consequences that I paid, and I definitely got, so you get sick and you get skinny and you get lazy and you get ugly and you get like a really, you know, bad time from using a lot of drugs and booze. But what I saw in my inventory was that my life was just as unmanageable without drugs and alcohol. I was just as crazy. So it just reiterated the fact to me again that I was, that I was the problem. That it wasn't the drugs and alcohol, which I thought for so long was my problem. If I could just stop drinking and doing drugs, I'll be fine. You know, I'll get the right boyfriend. I'll get an apartment. I'll get a car. I'll get a good job. I'll stop waitressing. I'll fix everything with all these outside things. And my experience proved to be that it was none of those outside things. That the happiness that I was ever going to find was to come from within, and it was to come from a relationship with a higher power. And it was to come from following through with, the steps that I started out with. I read my inventory. I went on to write a fear and a sex inventory. Sat down with another person and God, and I read it. And I meditated for an hour to ask everything that I had just read to be removed. And then I said a prayer. And that was 5, 6, and 7, which I did in a day. And then I went on, I made an amends list, and I became willing to make amends to the people that I had harmed. That's something that I never thought I would be able to do. But the steps that I took, the 1 through 7 before that, helped me to get to a place where I could become willing to go back to these places and make amends for what I had done, and the wrongs that I had done. And, you know, the freedom from making an amends, I would go back to my town and I would be like this, you know, like I was a train wreck. I was fighting with people all the time. I was, you know, I had boyfriends that were like, you know, punching me and throwing me down steps. And I was like running to their mother and crying. I mean, like I just had wreaked havoc, you know, I really had wreaked havoc. And, everybody knew I had tried to commit suicide twice. Everybody knew I was, you know, all these bad things. And you know, so going back and making amends for the wrongs I had done, and actually after having made a few to the places I had worked within my hometown, I walked out of these amends and I, like it says in the book, like I walked a free man. Like I held my head up high and I did not care who I saw. Like I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't, I was, I just like didn't care. Like in other words, I wasn't like anticipating anything, but I just, for the first time in my life, I had some relief from that awfulness in my head, that awful screaming that goes on in your head. I know for me, when the phone would ring or I'd see somebody I didn't want to talk to, I would just completely avoid everything. You know, I'd go like this if I saw somebody. If the phone rang and I didn't want to answer it, I'd, you know, just turn it off. Like, I ran from everything for such a long time. And after having gone through steps 1 through 7 and finally coming up to 9 and making some of these amends, I didn't have to hide anymore. After I made amends, I moved into a sober house. You know, something I said I would never do. When I first got to the place that I got taken through the steps, I said, "Portland, Maine, are you crazy? Like, that, where is that?" You know, I mean, I was like, "Oh God, it's literally an hour and a half away from Boston," but I thought it was like way too far away, you know, for, I thought like life doesn't exist in Maine, you know, I mean, that's really what I thought. I was like really bad. It wasn't but like 2.5 weeks later that I was like, you know, I couldn't wait to get up here. I mean, because I had done some honest work. For the first time in my life, it was revealed to me, like, what kind of person I really was, what I needed to do to become different. And notice how, like, I really haven't even mentioned this, like, whole alcohol and drug thing, because, like, that's kind of what happened when I took the steps. Like, it just went away. Like, it got lifted. Like, I didn't hang on to my seat. I didn't go buy $300 worth of yarn and sit in my house and go like this because I didn't know what else to do. You know, I didn't, like, watch, like, you know, tons of TV and, like, hide in my bedroom. And I watched, like, Law and Order over and over and over and over. I must have seen every episode 20 times because I couldn't leave my house. I was scared to death of life. But after I took the steps, like, I didn't even think about drugs and alcohol. It was absolutely the most beautiful thing that ever happened. It was removed. And that's what the promise of the book says. It says that the obsession around drugs and alcohol will be removed. Now, for this alcoholic, it has to be removed. I cannot fight the mental obsession. I cannot even, the thought cannot come into my head without a rational, like, answer to it, you know, which is just the thought of alcohol and drugs. But the obsession cannot occur in me because I will go out. So that's just how it is for me. I don't know how it is for everybody else, but I know for me that any time I got the mental obsession, I drank. I had no power to overcome it. So when the steps took that away from me, I was free. And it began to be not about not drinking and doing drugs, which prior, my sobriety prior to that, that's all it was about. It was like, okay, I've got 90 days. Okay, I've got 91 days. Okay, I got 92 days. You know, like, that's what it was like. I was like, oh my God, when are my parents going to die so I can shoot up? Like, that's what I was like, you know? Like, that's honestly what was happening to me. I was just waiting. I was just waiting for everybody to die. And this time, I wasn't even thinking of that. I was thinking, I was just funny because I was just talking, I almost have 2 years and I don't even know my sobriety date. I forget it sometime in June. But I don't even know because, see, like, my life today looks like, what can I do? What can I bring to the table? How can I be useful? Like, I have constant contact with God through prayer, meditation, and daily inventory and helping others. And I don't even think about drugs and alcohol. It's not a part of my life anymore. And that's one of the most, you know, freeing experiences that, you know, that any alcoholic or addict can have, you know, to imagine your life without the constant thought of drugs and alcohol. So the steps is what happened to me. I don't want to skimp over 10, 11, and 12, but what that looks like is, you know, after you've made some amends, you're halfway through your amends, there's a part in the book that's called The Promises, and, you know, I always heard them at the beginning of the meeting, and I remember when I went to, like, my second or third meeting, they asked me to come up and read The Promises, and, like, it went from one page to the next, and I had no clue what I was doing, and I'm shaking like this, and there's all these people, and I'm like, oh, does my hair look okay, and I hope, like, if there's a cute guy, he sees me, like, you know, I was, like, all retarded, and I read only half of The Promises, and I was like, thank you, and I sat down. I had no idea. But that just, I'm sorry, sometimes I go off on a tangent. But anyway, that was my experience. Like, you know, I was clueless, so I'm up here reading The Promises. They obviously mean nothing, but today they do. I mean, today they honestly do. They have come true. You know, there's all these things that my life brings to me today. You know, I take a 10-step, I take an inventory on a daily basis, I do a night reflection, I meditate. You know, not as good as I should. That's one of my goals, is to try to do at least 5 minutes a day this month, and I'm not doing so hot. But it's a goal, you know, it's progress, not perfection. And part of the meditation, the reason why, is because it's a time for you to listen to God. Like, I do a lot of talking all day and at work and with sponsees. And so, like, those 5 or 10 minutes that you can give yourself to listen to God and kind of realign yourself is a really cool cool way to go about doing this. You know, a nightly review, which is part of an 11-step. And then most of all, and most important of all, is a 12-step. And that's when you get to share your experience with somebody else. You get to see a sick and suffering person just like you were. And they're like, you know, they're rocking and rolling. They're like practically just, you know, they're practically dying right in front of you. And you get to tell them what happened to you, how you got better. Take them through the steps and watch them get better. You know, that's basically, you know, what my life looks like today. I help others, and I live a, what I would consider the life that, like, I always dreamed of living. You know, when I was younger, I was like, how do people, like, have an apartment and pay for it and pay their bills and, you know, like, and you know, actually, like, have a car and make car payments, or, like, you know, how do people, like, get up every day? Like, I don't want to, you know? I mean, that was, like, what my life looked like before. I was really concerned about how I was ever going to live. And now I just live, if you can imagine, and it just makes sense. I'm still, you know, fearful of things, but I have a tool today to, you know, get to the root of those fears. And I'm still resentful of things, but I have a tool today to get to those, the bottom of those resentments. And I have, you know, I basically just took these steps. Like, I just found somebody that was, you know, that knew what they were talking about, that had done them before me and gotten better. They took me through it, and then I took someone else through it, and it's just like this constant cycle, of, you know, of one alcoholic helping another and getting better, and that's basically, like, what I do. Like, I was a straight-up, like, cocaine heroin addict, and, you know, I mean, geez, I have scars all over my arms, you know, really bad, and... You know, I look at them sometimes, and I'm just like, wow, I just can't even believe that that was the person that I was. Like, I always heard people in AA say, like, you got to change the person that came in through the doors. And but and when I was in AA, I was sitting there, I was like, okay, change. You know, like, I was like, okay, when am I going to change? Like, what do I do? You know, like, I just thought, like, if I sat there in meetings long enough, I would change. I didn't realize that it was, like, this. You know, a program. It was a program of action. It was about seeking a higher power, and it was about, you know, taking suggestions and looking outside of myself and being concerned about others. That was actually the solution to my God-sized hole in my heart, if you will. I had a spiritual malady. I had a mental obsession. And I had an allergy to drugs and alcohol. It's like, I don't know who I said this to the other day, but it was like the perfect storm. You know, like that movie. Like, that's what it was. And having taken steps, you know, I found a spiritual solution. And I, you know, my broken mind started to heal itself. And the mental obsession was lifted for drugs and alcohol. And I've since then continued to take necessary steps to just continue to live a spiritual life and to just keep continuing on this down this path. So basically, I don't know if I can leave you with anything, you know, tonight. Like, I just hope, like, there's some hope, you know. Like, I was pretty hopeless. I definitely thought I was going to die of an alcoholic and an addict. I definitely didn't think there was any way I could get better. Maybe you could, but I was different. I was really bad, you know, like, that's what I told myself. But I did. I got better. I kid you not. Like, I got better from this. And I don't want to use today. And I don't have to use today either. I used a long time against my own will, and, you know, I just don't have to do that now. So, I guess I don't have anything else to say.